Good evening. My name is Meg Stemmler, and I produce programs for Live from the NYPL. Our mission, thank you, as set forth by Director Paul Holdengraber, is to create cognitive theater. Oh, should I start over? Okay. It is my pleasure to welcome you to Tactile Sound and the Pursuit of Silence in a Noisy World. Some programs to look forward to at Live this season include Peter Carey, Lena Herzog, John Waters, and Christopher Hitchens. This morning, tickets went on sale for Patti Smith, who will be here on April 29th in conversation with Paul Holdengraber. Become a friend of the library for just $40 and receive discounted tickets on every Live event. Please consider donating to Live from the NYPL. We're able to produce these evenings because of your support. After the program tonight, George Prochnick will be signing books sold by independent bookstore 192 Books. Through his book, In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise, George Prochnick explores the benefits of decluttering our sonic world. Speaking with doctors, neuroscientists, acoustical engineers, monks, activists, educators, marketers, and citizens, Prochnick examines what gets lost when we can no longer find quiet. George Prochnick is also the author of Putnam Camp, Sigmund Freud, James Jackson Putnam and the Purpose of American Psychology. George is also joined tonight by artists, researchers, and scientists including Wendy Jacob, Sheila Patek, Robert Servage, Christopher Ariza, Caitlin O'Connell-Rodwell, and Hansel Bowman. We will begin the evening with a conversation about In Pursuit of Silence. Please welcome Paul Holdengraber and George Prochnick.
I'm sorry that I have to break the silence, but I have to ask you what we just heard. I'm not quite sure.
That was a BBC recording of the 2 minutes of silence commemorating Armistice Day in 1938. England was really the first country that had a widely observed national moment of silence, and it was for Armistice Day, and it began in 1919. 10 years later, the BBC actually began broadcasting this live from the Cenotaph in the middle of London. And it proved enormously popular, so much so that it was continued for decades thereafter. And sometime in the 30s, a representative of the station spoke about what he thought was happening and why it was such an enormously popular event. And he said that its impressiveness was intensified by the fact that, of course, it's not dead silence. We hear Big Ben strike the hour. We listen to the bickering of sparrows. We hear the creasing of pigeon wings, he said. We hear all sorts of things in contrast to the din of traffic in London a moment before. And what he said the BBC's role was to allow people to recognize silence as a solvent which destroys personality and gives us leave to be great and universal.
It's quite a comment. Have they continued doing this?
They are not, to the best of my knowledge, broadcasting now. It stopped, and I think there may have been a brief assumption. It stopped, I want to say, about 20 years ago. And we might also note that recently there was a whole scandal about moments of silence observed in stadiums, which had been 2 minutes, and which diminished to 1 minute. And the 2 minutes of silence, the real ancestor of that, was 3 minutes of silence that was sparsely observed in South Africa. So we see these minutes of silence getting shorter and shorter over time.
So we have 30 seconds of silence to look forward to.
If we're lucky.
You, towards the end of your book, In Pursuit of Silence, you write, about a coalition of philanthropists who have purchased empty lots, and you encourage people to start hosting moments of silence. You say, let's hold a moment of silence in memory of silence. We have to find some means of giving more young people the opportunity of experientially learning why quiet is distinguished, or where we will, or there will be no distinction between noise and signal left. What did you mean?
Well, I mean, certainly one of the most profound discoveries for me in the course of this pursuit was of how many people there are in the world today for whom there simply is literally no moment of silence in their lives. Particularly this is true in disadvantaged communities that I visited, where in the homes there will often be a television on, someone speaking in a radio, there'll be lots of people living there. The streets are blasting with traffic. And for young people to have any reason to aspire to a quieter world, I think we have a responsibility as a larger society to provide them with context and physical spaces in which that silence can be discovered. Silence doesn't just happen magically. It needs a space. And
it needs certain conditions.
It needs conditions, real world conditions. We might all have our own moments of silence, I mean, that are mystical or what have you, but silence very much needs a place in the here and now.
After hearing those 2 minutes of silence, I started by saying that I had to break that silence. And you write about this breaking of silence as it is perceived by some philosophers. For instance, you quote Wittgenstein's famous, the end of the first book of philosophy, with a proposition, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And then you quote Heidegger, who once said, who declared, above all, silence about silence.
Words that haunted me throughout the writing of this book, particularly because this was part of a dialogue he carried on with a Japanese scholar, and the rejoinder of the scholar to this was, yes, because those who speak about silence produce the most obnoxious chatter. And I thought also that we'd gotten trapped in our ways of pitting noise lovers, or people at least who are loud, against noise haters, and we hadn't thought of any ways of speaking about silence that of a more sociable form of silence. We were positioning it all in terms of an inward journey. But I saw our social landscape as having this deficit which infects our politics profoundly. And one quote that really stuck with me from Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter, he spoke of how when the Constitution was being written, the framers of the Constitution had the road in front of Independence Hall covered with earth so that their deliberations would not be disturbed by passing traffic, because they felt our democracy presupposed the deliberative process as a condition of thought and responsible choice by the electorate. And at this moment in our discourse, I think the noise level and the efforts to dominate dialogue simply by volume of rhetoric have really given us a deficit of listening.
What do you think the etymology of both the words silence and noise tells us?
Well, if we start with noise, the etymology goes...
It's the right direction in which to go, from noise to silence.
I think. We go back to nausea, we go back to vertigo, seasickness. And many people have struggled with coming up with words with which to define noise. It's such a trap because it's so subjective, and people speak of unwanted sound, but so much of the noise is noise we desire. And people speak of unnecessary sound, but how do we begin to determine really what is necessary and not necessary in sound? And I came to think of noise as sound that, whether it was good or bad, gets inside our head and we can't get away from it. For the time that we're in a noise, it dominates our perception of the world. So we don't have room for other perceptions, even if it's something pleasurable. The idea of vertigo, I think, ties deeply into this, because we're swimming in a sound that has gone inside us and turned us into a little rocking boat.
So that noise, in some way, might we be correct in assuming that it robs us of our identity in some form or fashion?
It's a complex idea, but I think that actually that can be said. Let's circle back to that and say one thing about the etymology of silence, because I think it also speaks to that question. Two of the key antecedents for the word silence: one is a Gothic verb, anasalen, which means the wind dying down, and then the Latin desinere, meaning stop. So we have to think of silence as interrupted action. It's a very particular kind of action. It's a kind of action where we hold back from action. And what does that entail? And what, on the flip side, is the form of action which happens in the space of noise, that pushes us out of reflection, out of processing our environment, into a reactive state? And I think that when I think about the idea of losing identity in noise, I think about having to become Teflon in some way to what's stimulating me, so that I don't have time to absorb it, to digest it, to let it become part of me.
When I read the etymology of noise in your book, which I didn't know, I was reminded of a poem by Baudelaire, Une Passante, the first line of which is in French, La rue assourdissante autour de moi hurlait, which in the English translation here is amid the deafening traffic of that. Do I have it right? Yeah, amid the deafening of that. No. God, I'm getting this wrong now. I'll translate it myself. We have one of the finest translators of French poetry in this room. The deafening sound of the street. Screamed. The street, in a sense, is screaming. Is that what noise does? It just sort of robs us of our. It invades us so much that we can't function anymore.
I think invasion is a good word, and something that certainly many people that I spoke with over the course of my travels feel about this moment in our sonic world. They feel that they can't get away from the noise, that there's so many different sources coming at them, that they no longer have what I think of as these pockets of silence, which may have been present in the past. And this might be moving too far forward, but...
No, but should, Pockets leads me to one of my favorite moments in your book, and in a way, I was reading that poem of Baudelaire in Benjamin's beautiful book on Baudelaire. Your book itself is very Benjaminian in nature for me. It's a flânerie across many continents, but in particular, I think a certain concentration not only on Brooklyn, but also on certain parts of New York. And one of the minor heroes of this book is someone we don't usually think of as a hero, which is Thomas Hoving, who we all know as the former director before Philip de Montebello of the Metropolitan Museum, where he created, as I recall, the notion of the blockbuster. I've always been in. Do you know where the etymology, where the origin of the word blockbuster?
I don't.
That's interesting.
Tell me.
I'll tell you. The origin of the word blockbuster comes from the First World War, where bombs were dropped and would bust a whole block. Interestingly enough, the contrary of a blockbuster now is we call something that bombs, right? Which is quite interesting. But
you know, that's actually right. This is very germane because the origin of Hoving, what we're going to speak about, these very small parks that are called pocket parks that I came to feel were a real signal of hope in the midst of all the noise, was in fact bombed out lots in European cities that were in certain instances, rather than rebuilding, these were turned into small parks. And gradually, I mean, there was an idea that went back to Jacob Riis, but the first actually created parks were these ones in Europe. And then in America, there were a couple of scattered experiments, but Thomas Hoving...
Tell the story of how he... Because he went from these pockets of silence that he found to creating something quite the contrary, those blockbusters where noise was prevalent. So I'm interested...
I don't know if I can trace the transition from one to the other,
but
I can say...
You don't have to, but you talk about the pocket parks.
He was briefly, before becoming the director of the Metropolitan Museum, he was the New York City Park Commissioner. And with all the controversy that surrounded his tenure at the museum, as a park commissioner, he really got rave reviews from a remarkable cross-section of the city, politically, in terms of in every sense. And one of the reasons that he got this strong sense of accolade was because people felt he was really making, for the first time, parks for the people. And one of the, for me, most meaningful legacies of what he did, because some of the happenings and things that he organized in the parks, they haven't left so much, I think, a mark on us today. I would have liked to have seen some of them, because some of them sounded very interesting, but we don't really have anything comparable now. But what he did do was he created the city's first pocket park, Paley's Park, which is in Midtown, and there's another beautiful one.
10 blocks from here.
Very close to here, very close to the Museum of Modern Art. And he got William Paley, the CBS director, to finance the building of a park that just would take over a little building lot, and he put in a water feature, and he planted it with types of foliage that were very effective at absorbing sound. I don't know at that point how consciously that was part of what he did, but it's the case. And you step into this park, and you feel an enormous sense of respite from the din of the city. It's small, but it does a lot of what even much bigger silences can accomplish. And since Paley's Park was created in the late 60s, now we live in a time where, despite our sense of being so besieged, there is real hope, I think, in people who've built on this kind of work, learning much more about the ways that we perceive sound. And there are all sorts of fascinating studies that have been done looking at how the admixture of natural sound, even over a fairly heavily industrial trafficked area, can produce perceptions that are in the same family as silence. Even if, in a literal sense, say, water sounds, bird sounds, add another few decibels, people feel it to be quieter. And there are lots and lots of interesting, there's lots and lots of interesting work being done on these minutiae of what makes a difference. I mean, they found, for example, with water, you don't want water going over a metal grating because this reminds people of drainage. But if you have it, the ideal setting seems to be over small, irregular boulders, that this produces particularly certain high-frequency sounds that are just pleasing and that give us a sense of peace. So we don't, you know, we're not going to be able to go back to some mythical moment. And this is something I know that you want to talk about. And we
well, I'm interested. I'm interested in getting slowly to what I see a tendency in you of finding a prelapsarian self, a moment of silence that we, with some hope, might be able to get to, but which may never have actually existed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if we think about this moment in time, in terms of the pursuit of silence, it's a triply post-lapsarian moment. We're living after the third sonic fall. And I think this is the case because, first of all, as we all know, there is no absolute silence. There's nothing there. Absolute silence is the ending of all vibrations, is total death. Then we have the second layer of sound, which is infrastructure sound, the traffic noise from road and air and from manufacturing process that we've been living with for generations and that we've allowed to really dominate our what some people refer to as the soundscape, the acoustical landscape in which we live. And now, on top of that, I believe and argue, partly because of that second layer, that second sonic fall, we have the third layer where we, to soundproof ourselves, and in fact, to create a version of silence, which I can explain why I mean that, we plug in, we put on our earbuds, we put on our headphones, we put on our own sound devices as a way of both exerting control over the noise so that at least if we are going to be dominated by noise, it's noise we choose. And also because, frankly, we've turned so many of our public spaces into noise dumping grounds that what we can put through a direct sound feed into our ears is often more interesting. And I think it's important to say that there is a tendency among my generation to look at, you know, young people with ubiquitous use of iPods and et cetera, and sort of say, turn it off and get it down, and, you know, why are you doing that? It's so loud. But I really think the responsibility as to why that happened lies with us. So
we're complicitous in some way.
We're collaborators because we didn't, if we knew something about silence while there still was some, we didn't do a very good about sharing our knowledge of what benefits silence might bring. And we didn't go about certainly creating democratically accessible spaces where silence could take place.
Is there not something a little bit odd and maybe precious in the notion of fabricating silence?
I don't think this is about fabricating silence. I think it's about defabricating the noise. I mean, and this gets into some of the terminology that's directly used by some of the soundscapers and urban planners who I really like.
Say something about soundscaping.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is a term. It's a term that is bandied about very loosely, and it can mean pretty much, it seems at this point, what anyone wants it to mean. But in some way, I guess, there's a beautiful, beautiful book by Murray Schafer called The Soundscape that came out now, I guess, probably 30 years ago, that looks at a whole, he coined the phrase, really, and he looked at a whole number of aspects of what is the sonic world that we live in, and tried to analyze them and talk about
according
what we're...
According to different cities also?
Different cities and different places.
Different cities sound differently.
Different cities. Well, this is a whole subject in itself. But I'm using it now in the sense of people who work to encourage, not to fabricate, but to encourage certain sounds and to maybe discourage certain others. And often it's a very, very low-tech enterprise. I can think of one example of what I'm speaking of, but let me jump into a specific example. In London, in Trafalgar Square, there was a man I spoke with who was an urban planner who was very conscious that the fountain in the center of the square could no longer be heard from anywhere. And he felt this was a real shame.
And a loss.
And a terrible loss. But he also found that simply by diverting traffic from one side of the square, that he freed up a channel for the sound to flow from the fountain and be bounced off the portico of the National Gallery right on top of where people were standing, which was exactly the point at which you would want to admire the sight and sound of the fountain together. Soundscapers like this speak of recovering iconic sounds of different environments. So what can you do if there was a church bell in a neighborhood, which was a beautiful thing, or there was a pocket of trees that actually was very conducive to biodiversity and created its own little bird chorusing? How can you recover that? How can you recover the sound of footsteps along a particular street? And the dark side of soundscaping is something else, which I think there's great dangers will become more and more part of our lives. There's a whole commercial side to it that's happening in cars and with products, and that's often about adding actually another layer of ostensibly pleasant electroacoustical sound. I visited, if I can just say one further thing, I visited a park in Sweden, in Malmö, which had an indentation. It was near all sorts of different activity, producing all sorts of different noise, from children, from people playing sports, not so far from a road, a very windy place. And they created a pocket of what could have been silence, which was a depression, just a very simple thing, a depression in the earth with rich plantings that walled off a lot of the sound. And then they stuck speakers all through the ground, and it was playing constantly music that they decided would help people's perception of silence. But, you know, maybe some people, and for a lot of people, it was just, I'm not in the mood for a kind of a hip muzak.
And you take us through in your flânerie through various cities and through New York in particular. You take us to places where noise, as it were, is fabricated, whether it be in restaurants, whether it be in department stores, just the extraordinary level at which we are manipulated. Can you say a few words about that, but not too many, because I'd like to actually have us focus more on the oral truffles, which we'll get to in a minute.
Well, certainly in terms of restaurants. I spoke with many restaurateurs about why their dining establishments were excruciatingly loud. And there really was a consensus.
And one can hear a laughter here because everybody in this room recognizes that. I mean, and there are no guidebooks that I know that have an entry quiet restaurants. And
there are. I mean, even in the New York Times reviews, they'll rate it. They will talk about tolerably loud, intolerably loud, and in San Francisco.
But I'd like a section. I'd like a section in the book.
I had a section. It didn't remain. There needed to be more silence in the book, so I didn't get to do it all. But you know, all of the restaurateurs spoke to me about a fear of seeming dead. They said, if we're not, you know, if a place is loud, and many of them said for them too, it was a counterintuitive discovery, that they, while they would have thought that noise at a certain level would have turned people off, they just found the louder it was, the more people sensed it was really happening. It had a literal buzz.
And by really happening, it also means people are drinking more.
Since you can't talk, you
open your mouth to drink. I mean, you do describe this
in the book. The most rigorous study that was done on this subject in France a couple of years ago found, while there's still uncertainties about what happens to our pace of eating, we definitely drink more when things are loud. And I would say, I would tie this in to the physical reality of sound as a stimulant. It's a particular kind of stimulant that makes us crave more stimulation. But we, you know, those of us who feel not so friendly towards noise a lot of the time have to understand that there's a real energy that you're given by it. And this form of stimulation, one study that I saw looking at the nature of this was actually looking at ecstasy with rats. And there were some Italian researchers who gave one group of rats ecstasy in a completely silent kind of monastic rat environment. And another in the environment, which for those who've experienced this drug might be a little more typical for MDMA, of quite loud discotheque. And what they found was that the rats who were given ecstasy in relative silence, their brains cleared up overnight almost entirely. But the rats who were in the discotheque, the mini rat club, their brains were fried for a week. I mean, just the electrical cortical parameters were completely tangled and confused, and they were just a mess. Which reminds me of another rat experiment on the same subject. This one from 1930 in Tokyo, where there was a group of scientists who took two groups of rats, one of which they raised in the silence of the laboratory, and the other of which they raised beneath an elevated train with more than 1,200 passages back and forth every day. So they were convinced that what would happen to the rats underneath the train would be that they would just die from noise because it was so extreme. Their organs would collapse, they would be very unhappy, so on and so on. Well, in fact, the rats were very unhappy, and they were nervous wrecks, and they were aggressive, and they were less fertile, and they weren't as smart as the other rats. Less fertile. Their fertility. There have been studies looking at actually fertility rates close to airports that have found drops in human fertility as well. But the twist was that they found that the rats raised beneath the trains also lived 53 days longer than the rats raised in silence. So what this means, I haven't seen a follow-up since 1930, the Tokyo Hygiene Laboratory, but it suggests to me that, and they repeated it afterwards, they had a group of rats raised in the main newsroom of a major daily in Tokyo, and then they had rats raised next to a very loud, constantly ringing bell. And in each instance, the results were the same. The rats raised in noise were horrible rats to be around and very unhappy rats, but they had longevity of a really impressive...
So they were horrible to be around for a long time. Yeah. I would like to, first of all, pause for a moment to recognize our signers and thank them so much for being here. This is the very first time, at least in the experience I've had with this program, that we have had signers. So thank you very much.
I'd like everybody to thank them. Yeah, I want to interrupt the applause because the correct way to applaud, if you're applauding within the deaf community, is actually not by making noise, but to raise your hands over your heads and kind of twist them. So let's have everyone give applause that will be recognized in this way. Thanks. Thank you very much.
You start out the book and finish the book, actually, being rather worried of your own kindness towards the world. And you say, I'll only read this one line on the very first page in the introduction, that you're scared of becoming a noise crank.
I mean, it's scary.
But yes, it is scary, but George, are you a noise crank?
Well, let me just say...
In my defense. No.
I have always had an affinity to silence. I don't know if that makes... That sounds a lot better. I don't know if that makes me automatically a noise crank. But I've had this affinity to silence, and it's bound up with my passion for reading, which I've had for as long as I've had an identity. And I think of a line by a writer that we both care for, Stefan Zweig, the turn-of-the-century Viennese writer, who once defined a book as a handful of silence that assuages torment and unrest. And I knew that I'd had this instinctual predilection all my life. As I grew older, I was aware that there seemed to be less and less of the silence that I was drawn to be had. And I really set out on this pursuit, trying to determine whether there was an objective change in the world of sound or whether I was just becoming more crotchety with age. Which is a tendency. I can say something, if you'd like, about where I ended up coming down in terms of the question of whether or not anything has changed.
Yes.
I think something has changed. But I think it's a mistake to...
Changed in...
In terms of what we hear in the world around us.
And the volume of what we hear.
Well, that's a trickier question. And let's back into it.
Okay.
Certainly, if we were to go to a Victorian industrial city, if we were to be living in mid-19th century London, it would be very possible that where we were living was much, much louder than where most of us are living today, because you might be living next to a factory with very long hours, and the factory might be doing extremely heavy manufacturing of one sort or another. In fact, there are all sorts of issues where I think progress has been made in terms of zoning noise. And there's a fascinating paper that I came across that speculated that the Greek city-state of Sybaris might have become as refined and sophisticated as it did entirely because they had early noise zoning. But it didn't exist for most cities for most of time. I think there were many, many objectively very loud noise sources. However, that said, if you were living in mid-19th century London, or at least in many, many other places, I think it was much easier to find the kinds of pockets of silence from which you could take some refuge, some peace, find some sense of sanctuary than many of us have today. I think that there was more of what some urbanists speak of as acoustical contrast than we readily have access to. So that part of why we feel so besieged, I believe, with sound, with types of sounds that sometimes are not objectively all that loud, has to do with the fact that it's an incessant barrage of these sounds.
And you, in your journey, actually went out to find the loudest among the communities who barrage themselves willfully with
sound. It's the loudest outside of military activity, and so in a way the loudest, yes, that's entirely willful, which was the world of extreme car audio competition.
And we had the idea at one moment, George and I, when we were putting this event together, to somehow feature some of it, and then we decided to go more towards silence and
We thought about trying to get some of the people I met, some of whom I felt very fondly towards, is the reality, try to come up with their cars. But their cars it's like moving a dinosaur to move them around. Most of them don't drive. They're stuffed with, you know, a dozen car batteries. They're not really made
to
drive.
What do they do?
All they do is play music. They're walled
off.
And
you went in one of those cars.
I went in one of those cars.
And describe the experience.
Well, what really stands out for me in the experience that I had, I thought it would be fun to drive around in one of these cars, like they do, like they like to drive around, and sort of feel what it was like. And I got in the car, and this was in Florida, and I haven't spent much time in Florida. It was a very ugly part of Florida, but an area with many, many big highways. And it was pretty fun driving down this highway, booming along, and we were playing the music, and I thought, oh, you know, I get this. I thought this was fine. And then suddenly there was a dashboard. The whole inside of the car, I should say, was covered with black. It was, all the windows were painted with metallic reflecting surfaces. You couldn't see anything, and there were coils, and you felt like you were inside Frankenstein's head, not exactly inside a car. And suddenly there was a lunar panel, I thought of as a lunar panel, on a science fiction vessel, lit up, and the finger of my companion started pushing buttons, and I suddenly realized he hadn't yet turned on the sound system. And within 2.5 seconds, I just buckled forward and just felt, I'm dying. This is it. I just felt my organs are collapsing. I actually felt I was being crushed. And he quickly kind of started dialing it down, just said, I didn't want to cause you pain. And I said, how loud was that? And he said, oh, it gets much louder than that. These cars, they're so loud inside them, the air actually begins to act like water. It doesn't feel like air. It's thick. You can't, the molecules are so compressed, and everything sounds underwater. Whenever I listen to my tapes of the music, it sounds like you've stuck a boombox inside of your bathtub, because it's just, everything is slowed down. So there's
sound becomes tactile then.
Sound becomes tactile, which is something that we're going to be looking at shortly. And I'll just say that when I then, later on, stood probably close to 20 yards away from the truck of someone known as Tommy the King of Bass, which is the loudest, I think, non-driving truck in the world. I was very far away from this. And when he turned it on, I had a cell phone in my pocket, and I was wearing somewhat loose clothing. And suddenly, the cell phone started going like this in my pants, and my clothes were rippling off of top of me. And I could actually see, we were in a strip mall parking lot, and I could see a line of plate glass windows rippling like black sails in a storm. Light bulbs on very high street lamps were starting to vibrate and looked like they were going to fall on all of our heads. And a number of staff from a McDonald's about 100 yards away began running down to us furiously, because people could no longer hear their orders as they were being given at the drive-in McDonald's, which I guess is a perennial problem in the parking lot of Tommy the King of Bass, when he brings out the Loch Ness Monster, which is what he calls his car. Yes, it's tactile.
You were talking about the relationship between your lust or love for silence and your proximity to reading. And I'd love you to develop a little bit this relationship, because in some way the negative for me is that the desire to be perpetually surrounded by music, as you are describing it now, in stores, in cars, is perhaps a fear of being in solitude or alone. I'm reminded in this particular context of one of the quotations I've most loved by the English psychoanalyst Winnicott, who said that the goal for the child is to be alone in the presence of the mother, which to my mind has always been the best description of reading I have known.
Oh, that's beautiful. I can't improve upon that except to say that I'm very aware when I'm hearing sound that, I mean, for me, reading is a process of entering the words physically in some way. And if there's something entering me, if there's sound waves entering me, even if they're not informed by language, I can't go down that particular rabbit hole. It's closed for me. And this may have a great deal to do with attention, which I think is the other aspect of what we are very threatened with in the current noise barrage.
Attention and distraction.
Attention and distraction. I mean, yeah, Schopenhauer called noise the single greatest enemy of the philosopher. And he said that this was so because he said, the only thing that I have, paraphrasing, is my ability to concentrate on one thing for a long period of time. That's
you know,
it.
Simone Weil called that prayer. I mean, she made a direct relationship between attention and being in a state of grace.
I think that's nice. And for Schopenhauer, whose particular bugbear was the cracking of coachmen's whips, he would sit
Imagine him today. Yeah.
I don't think we'd have his books, probably, and it may say something about the books we do have. I mean, and I include my own very much in that. It's, you know, my book is not a steady look at one thing. But what he felt is that interruption that happens was actually, to come back to the question that you raised at the beginning, the interruption of his identity. That there really was nothing left once that concentration was broken of him as philosopher. It was simply gone. And I think we need to read with a devout concentration. I mean, Thoreau has that great line about to read a great book being as difficult as to write it. And Thoreau, to me, is a mentor on silence again and again. I mean, he has extraordinary things to say.
I keep wondering what it means to be attentive in an age of distraction. And, you know, I'm reminded of T.S. Eliot's great line, distracted from distraction by distraction. And I'm prone to it all the time. I mean, my BlackBerry has become, it's my forbidden fruit. My children no longer know it as a fruit, but as a machine. Well, and our thoughts, I mean, in your book you have the story of a painter who feels overtaken, as it were, by sound because he can no longer direct his own life, because the sound is what is directing his life. And the same happens with these machines, which interrupt, and willfully perhaps we let them interrupt our life so that we do not have to concentrate, because there might be fear in concentration.
And maybe we should slightly complicate that by saying it's not that we don't concentrate, but we concentrate on the immediate stimulus. We do concentrate. We concentrate on every single thing that is grabbing our attention sonically or visually in our environment.
And there may be great benefits to that.
There are certain benefits. I think there are benefits conceivable. Certainly if you're in war, you want that kind of immediately reactive.
Is that the life we're leading?
No, I don't think we're fighting a battle. That's the problem. I think we're fighting ourselves. I mean, we're at war with something deep in our natures. To that point, though, there was a study that I saw very recently that was done by someone who has looked at the limits of the idea, a neuroscientist who has looked at the limits of the idea of multitasking and basically has shown that multitasking is a myth, that we have so much attentive power, and if it goes one place, there's less of it to go somewhere else. And he did a recent study at Vanderbilt looking at what it means to be blinded by surprise. But by blinded, he means overcome, the inability to think. And it appears that there's a part of the brain, a small, modest little part, called the inferior frontal junction, which I thought when I read an account of the study of it almost like a stereoscope, where it brings things into, correlates things into three dimensions. And what this part of the brain does is it correlates external stimuli with directed thought coming from inside us. And in the analogy he used, if the scientist who did the study, if one is reading and a siren goes off outside, an alarm, what happens is we can no longer bring into focus those two tracks of mental activity, and we are literally incapable of further thought for a brief period of time. And certainly to go back to that goal-directed thought is gone. So there is really increasing hard understanding, hard brain understanding, if you will, of the consequences of being interrupted constantly.
In closing, and before I ask you to read a passage, another two questions. One is the real, who I take to be the real hero of your book, a man whose work I had never known before, and I'd like you to say something about him because he seems fascinating, both in his work and the way he quite tragically ended, which is Thomas Lessing.
Theodore Lessing. Yes. He was an enormously complicated person, and is now largely forgotten, but he was the one who really wrote first extensively on the idea of of the self-hating Jew is maybe the thing. If he's known for anything, he's most known for having defined that concept. He was a Jew himself living in early 20th century Germany, in Hanover primarily. And at one point, he became very involved fighting or working with the problem of noise. And he had an enormous number of insights, I felt, into why people make noise. And he was enormously also concerned with various reform movements. He was not in any way an elitist. He worked very, very hard on behalf of the people, and he was very sympathetic to people who made noise. And he talked about the idea that whether it's the coachman cracking his whip or the maid putting out the bedding for a house, or it's a drummer banging on a drum, he said people make noise as a way of magnifying their sphere of power. It's a way of extending your personal space, particularly important for people who don't have that much space, and perhaps we could say in an increasingly overcrowded earth, particularly important for many of us. But what Lessing came to, what he came to as a way of dealing with this, as he, since he wasn't someone who just wanted to try to tell people to shut up who were making a lot of noise, is he began trying to infuse a greater consciousness of the benefits of silence and tried to appeal to people's nobler nature, and said he had this phrase for his organization, quiet is distinguished. And he didn't mean that as a call for the elites to close ranks, but he meant to say to people who didn't have much chance for distinction in their lives, you know, this is a distinction that is available to you. You know, let me show you some of the ways you can get access to it. And he had all sorts of quirky schemes. He wanted to put schools in the middle of woods, and he created houses that would have special colored cards in the windows indicating that no parrots or pianos were allowed, that it was going to be a completely quiet house. And he did all sorts of things. But what I really took from him, and what I really came to feel in the course of my pursuit, is that, all right, the same way I don't think we can say that it is, I don't think we can say that it is noisier today than it was at X point in the past, but I do think that we can say that there's less silence today than there was in the past. And I think that rather than just being against noise and telling people who often have no experience of silence, be quiet, people who at this point, as I found, literally don't know what that means a lot of times, we've got to start showing them how to be for silence. And we've got to give them a space to do it, and it's got to be experiential. I mean, a line from Thoreau, he said that silence has different depths and fertilities like soil. And I think different silences have different textures and different characters, and we need to give people a chance to explore these if we want our sound world to change.
In closing, really, yeah. In the You said, in the course of my pursuit. I was very taken by the title of your book, In Pursuit of Silence.
Let me just say to that, the philosopher Kenneth Burke once remarked that mystical silence began in the hunt. And he said that the quest naturally occurs in silence, whether it's an animal stalking its prey or it's a thinker seeking the answer to the question. The start of the question is silence. And this I liked a lot one thought. A lot of what I looked at in the book was the evolutionary history of silence. I mean, why were animals silent to begin with? Well, we lived in a world where noises meant danger and where our ability to hear noises, our ability to take the acoustical temperature of where we were, was a matter of life and death. And I think what we really have to do is find a way of reinvesting interest in the sound of our public spaces so that people, again, want to hear what they sound like rather than wanting to drown them out.
Let me drop my idea of pursuing In Pursuit of Silence and framing you between Descartes and Proust and say that you really are interested in the animal kingdom, because you say here, I thought about frog eggs, snakes. Why did you think about frog eggs? What's so interesting about them?
Well, there was a particular reason I was thinking about frog eggs. It may be a little difficult to speak of briefly, but there's a particular kind of frog egg.
It will connect us to the second
that
part.
That is sensitive to, it will, it's true, if I can articulate it. These frog eggs are sensitive to vibrations in the water where they are laid. And in fact, what these frog eggs have the ability to do is to determine whether the sounds in the water are taking place randomly, like rainfall on the water, in which case they're safe, or they can tell if the vibrations are being made by a snake coming to devour them. And when these larvae sense patterned vibrations, they can prematurely bird themselves and shoot out and become little froglings and get away. So there's a lot to think about there, I think.
I'd like you, in closing, to read a passage. Maybe the oral...
Okay, that's exactly halfway through the book, so
maybe,
that's good.
Or maybe the last pages. Or would you like me to read the last page? Because I'd like to leave people with the sound of that last page of yours. I'd love you to read both, but I know we don't have that much time.
I know we don't have time. Well, I don't know how to answer that. I will be silent to your words.
Read the oral truffle.
All right. Well, in the middle of the book, I was very tired with my various explorations of noise, so I wanted some silence. Having neither time nor money for a holiday flight, I decided to go on a tour of oases of silence near my Midtown office. As a matter of principle, pursuing silence should be pleasurable, like hunting for prize wild mushrooms or bathing in mild seas, not painful, like striving to flatten one's stomach or to maintain a stern budget. Wherever you live, there are ways of finding silence. It's just that these ways are often not as pleasant as they should be. Silence is still around, but often it's been marginalized to the point where it conveys the prospect of eternal silence a little too vividly. Abandoned, broken glass-strewn lots behind barbed wire, vacant buildings and mortuaries might be quiet, but at what cost? That said, the basic strategy for locating the remaining sites of silence in your hometown is to envision it as the Costa del Sol. The beach is out of the question. All the places people are naturally drawn to for work, recreation, and shopping are going to be impossibly loud. But a short distance inland cuts the crowds down to a dribble of locals, and suddenly one finds oneself in an authentically foreign place. So ask yourself, what is the interior of the place I live? Where do surf and sand stop? What's the road no one bothers to drive? The bench where no one sits? In many cities, the land underneath the yawning arches where old bridges sink their foundations is a place of refuge, as are the tops of undistinguished skyscrapers. In smaller towns, historical societies and libraries with inadequate internet connections are almost invariably deserted. Museums of unfashionable subjects are a good bet anywhere. You can almost always hear a pin drop in collections attached to schools of medicine. Cemeteries on weekdays, wherever you live, are an obvious but reliable refuge. Just remember to keep asking, where's the culture pulling everyone? Now turn around and walk the other way. Keep walking. Manhattan might not seem like the most promising foraging ground for a couple of hours of silence, but I'm in an especially fortunate area for hunters of that aural truffle. My own circuit is small and more effortless than it might be in many ostensibly quieter communities. And that leads into the pocket parks.
Thank you very much. And now we will move effortlessly into our second part of the evening, and I'd like to encourage all of you to read In Pursuit of Silence. It's a magnificent book. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Paul.
The platform in the center of the Bartos Forum, right in the middle there, is designed to carry tactile sound. Tactile sound is sound you perceive through your body, through your bones, joints, and skin, rather than by sound waves through your ears. By making contact with the platform, you will be able to perceive sound tactilely. Frequencies above 20 hertz, you will also be able to perceive aurally. The platform is also for the collection of research on low-frequency vibration. This evening, four presenters will discuss their work involving low-frequency vibration, as well as deaf experience in relation to spatial navigation. The platform will carry the sounds of their research. During the presentations, you are welcome to sit, stand, lie on the platform. At the end of the evening, we'll be playing all of the sounds again on the floor, so if you missed it during the presentations, you can experience it again at the end. As George said, in American Sign Language, deaf applause is expressed by holding your hands in the air and shaking them. So this evening, we request that you refrain from clapping and instead wave your hands in the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming tonight, and thank you to all the organizers for planning an amazing evening. I'm going to talk tonight about sound sensations in the sea. I'm a biologist, and I study animals that are supposedly deaf, but actually live in an incredibly rich acoustic world. And actually, earlier this week, I had been thinking about how I was going to pull together this talk, and it actually connects remarkably well to what we just heard about. I live in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is a lovely, away from the coast, very peaceful place, and I like to bike to and from work. And I was bicycling home one day, listening to the birds and the farmland, and it was really peaceful. And then I heard the dreaded sound of the freight train coming, and I knew I was going to be late to pick up my daughter at school, and I knew that freight train was going to be at that intersection where the railroad track crosses the road. And then it came, and I knew I'd have to sit there and wait. And I heard it coming with my ears, right? But when I was there on my bicycle, right next to that train, I realized my entire body was vibrating. And it wasn't coming through the ground. I was pulsing with the feeling of that freight train. And I was thinking, wow, wouldn't it be cool if humans, we didn't talk, we didn't communicate just through our mouths, but what if we communicated by vibrating each other's bodies? What that would feel like, how cool that would be? And while I was thinking that, I was thinking, oh my gosh, that is exactly how the animals I study communicate with sound. They don't listen with their ears. They actually feel the vibrations that they're producing with their whole bodies. So that's what I'm gonna talk about for the next 15 minutes, or maybe now 13 minutes. So, to set the stage, this is a picture of where I do a lot of my field work, which is in Southern California, an island called Catalina Island. And it's a beautiful place, and you might be inclined to sit up on the side of the bay there and experience the peace and quiet, and actually it is very peaceful. You might hear some birds singing or some crickets. But the moment you go into the water and immerse yourself in the water, this is what you hear, and it is very far from silent. And I'm not playing like some especially noisy moment in the ocean. This is what it sounds like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And this is the sound of animals eating, moving, fighting, singing love songs, you name it. All the time, this constant roar. And, you know, we've just heard so much about how loud our terrestrial environment is in the air, but the environment in the water is incredibly loud. And it's for a really simple physical reason, because the way sound works in air is fundamentally different than how it works in water. And I'll draw a little analogy before I dive into a little bit of science. And the analogy is, so when you were walking here tonight and perhaps someone passed you on the sidewalk, you might have felt maybe a brush of air, but probably nothing at all. But if you were in the water and you snorkeled from past someone else or a big shark swam past you, you would literally feel them go past you. Your whole body would vibrate. And this is fundamentally because water transmits vibrations far more effectively and efficiently than in air. So I'm going to do a little bit of physics here, but considering how challenging the literature I just heard talked about and the references there, but I stayed with it as a scientist, I think you guys can handle a little bit of physics about sound, because it's going to make all of this connect a lot easier. So this is a picture, a little movie of a wave, right? The classic wave you might do at a stadium, and where each person stands up in sequence and this wave travels, but the individual actually doesn't move, right? We can make it more science-y and just represent it as a string where you lift up one end. The string doesn't go anywhere, but that wave travels along the string. Now, if we look at a sound wave, a sound wave is made of little vibrations of the particles, whether it's particles of air or particles of water, and the particles themselves don't actually move and go somewhere else. They stay where they are, they just move back and forth. And as they move, a region of high pressure is followed by a region of low pressure. And so you have two layers here, right? The movement of the pressure wave, and you also have the movement of the actual molecules. And you might imagine sticking a little sensory hair next to one of these particles that's moving, and it might be moved by it. You might feel it. However, in air, for you to be able to feel the vibration of that particle, you have to be very, very close, or it has to be an incredibly loud, low-frequency sound. In water, however, these vibrations die off much, much, over a much longer area. So you can sense these vibrations over five times greater distances than you can in air. And what this boils down to is that in water, these particle movements can be detected over a fivefold greater distance in air. And this means that the ability to sense sound is fundamentally different. It opens up some new areas and new ways to experience sound. So we're most familiar with our own ears that are these membranes, and they sense that pressure wave that comes along. And there's that little membrane in the ear called the tympanic membrane, and it has air behind it and air in front of it. And it vibrates when that pressure wave hits it. The way the animals I study here is through sensory hairs. And they have these wonderful little sensory hairs all over their bodies. This is just a picture of a crab. And if you can see it from the back there, it's actually covered with tons of tiny little hairs all over its feet. And these are the hairs that they experience sound with, they experience vibration with. They actually experience vibration with their whole bodies. And one of the most wonderful things about studying this aspect of sound and hearing in biology is that all my colleagues think these animals are deaf because they don't have true ears. And instead, actually, which means that most of them have not been studied very well, but thousands, if not millions, of crustaceans are communicating with sound. They're just using vibration and experience of these vibrations through these particle vibrations with hairs. And so I'd like to include them in the hearing world if possible. But that's why I study them, and I do think that their experience of sound rivals those with true ears. So in a nutshell, because it's easier to detect particle movements in water, vibration-sensitive hairs are effective ears in the ocean. So let's take a look at sound sensations in two crustaceans. I'll tell you two very short stories about sounds in crustaceans. One is about mantis shrimp, and the other is about spiny lobsters. And I'll introduce you to the mantis shrimp. This is California mantis shrimp. It's over a foot long. It's a big guy. And here's a little video of it exploring its world. It's actually coming up out of the muddy substrate. It built a little hole in the ground. And you might notice that you're not hearing anything. And I'm doing it this way because this is, if you watch a show on National Geographic about, you know, underwater life, this is all you'll hear. Because actually most people don't realize that these animals are making a lot of noise. In fact, I'll bet that that animal just made a lot of noise at the camera because it was really irritated to have a camera in front of its burrow. So what I'd like to do is convince people to turn on the recorders to experience what these animals are doing. And that's what we've been doing, actually, a lot of in the ocean lately. So let me play you a sound that these animals make in an aquarium. It's called a rumble. And this was the first recording, as far as I know, that anyone ever made of this animal, a group of animals that consists of over 500 species that have been around on this planet for a really long time. And more recently, we've been trying to listen to them in the ocean. And Erica Statterman is a young scientist in my lab, and she's been spearheading this work. She's absolutely remarkable. And she's gone out to the field to convince these animals to record them. And I'll play you the sound of animals in their natural habitats, in their burrows, talking to each other. So they're going, ho, ho, ho. Isn't that great? Aren't you glad we turned on the audio recorders? And then just to put it in line with our this theme of today, this is what it sounds like when one of our recreational boaters goes by. It's obliterated. And this is one of Erica's major, I think will be her life's work, is understanding, before we even had a chance to start to understand the sounds these animals are making, we're obliterating them. And so we're actually trying to find quiet places in the ocean to hear these animals making noises. So those are our mantis shrimp. They produce these sounds by vibrating a muscle on the side of their body, and it vibrates the edge of their carapace and kind of like a speaker element. So let's take a look at the spiny lobsters. A really different story. These guys don't have claws. They're in a different family than our main lobsters. They fight with their antennae. They have superpower antennae, and at the base of these antennae is a sound-producing apparatus. So this is the sound of one spiny lobster asking you to please get out of the way. These are slightly higher frequency, so might be harder to hear on the floor. You might imagine hearing, if you tried to go in and grab one of these lobsters from this large group of them, you might imagine hearing 150 of these. It would be a little scary. And that is, in fact, what they use it for. They produce the sounds to scare away predators. So, for example, they produce it when they're interacting with octopus, which, by the way, octopuses don't have true ears. However, they can experience and respond to these sounds. And it's a scary sound, so hopefully it scares the octopus away. Octopus eats spiny lobsters. The other way that works is it reminds hearing fish. There are many fish with true ears as well as vibration-sensitive systems, and reminds fish that they had a bad experience with the spiny lobsters, and hopefully they'll think yuck and they'll go away. So that's what these sounds are for. And this is a sound of a Caribbean spiny lobster. I'll play it for you. It's a little bit loud, so hopefully I won't scare you to death. Can you guys hear that on the floor? Awesome. They make these sounds by rubbing a little extension off the base of their antenna over their head, like this. So I have special skills as a biologist. And one of the really cool things, you can see it here at the base of the antenna. I painted the moving part green and the stationary part red. Is that it turns out they produce sound like a violin. They use stick and slip friction, same underlying physics that we use during when we produce sound with bowed stringed instruments. And this was a major discovery when we figured it out a few years ago. And so it's the first biological analog to a violin. And this is interesting because this is, of course, one of our major delicacies as humans, and we had never gotten around to figuring out how they make the sound after all these thousands of years of eating them. But what's also interesting is that this is how chalk, squeaky chalk, makes sound, that strange combination of pressure and speed. Makes a horrible noise. And it's also the fundamental frictional basis for a lot of earthquakes. And somehow, over evolutionary history, these lobsters have been able to tame this mechanism of physics and make some fabulous noises. They're wonderful diversity, all different colors. These are some pictures I took in Japan, some deep sea and shallow lobsters. These are some of the sound-producing apparatuses taken at a fish market in Okinawa. They're beautiful animals. And I've recorded their sounds from all over the world. I'll finish up with two sounds. This is a sound of a lobster I recorded in Japan. And here's one from Ireland. Wonderful diversity. And these animals have been around on the planet for over 220 million years. It's an ancient mechanism of sound production and hearing, and it's fascinating to dig into it finally. And so to conclude, what I hope I've been able to do here is to expand your perspectives on what is sound, how you can communicate with sound, but also maybe encourage you the next time you get to go to the ocean to open up your ears and your body experiences, and maybe you'll also hear some of this fantastic biological sound that we're only now just starting to discover. Thank you so much for your attention.
I guess I'm just going to go ahead with my presentation. Testing, testing, testing. Hello, everyone. Thank you for the patience of setting everything up and making sure the interpreters were well set up. I'm ready to go ahead and give my presentation. And I just want to let you know that as I'm signing, I'll also be, it's basically a process of ASL as well as English. So my name is Robert Servich. I actually grew up in Canada. I went to Gallaudet University, which is located in Washington, D.C., and my occupation is an architect. I'm a designer. I also wanted to introduce Hansel. He's an architect as well, and he's involved with the project that I'll be discussing this evening. And you know George, he also actually went to Gallaudet University, came to Gallaudet University to research for the book that he presented to you. He wanted to go to Gallaudet to get an idea of how deaf people there, how silence is perceived by the deaf people there. And actually, we figured, you know, we can help him out with that. Not that he needed our help; he's definitely smart enough. But we definitely wanted to give him an idea of our way of doing things. So, as I mentioned, I also do research in design, and the general goal is to find harmony, the different elements of interaction and how that relates to design so that the design facilitates that interaction. So we're trying to figure out what the yardstick would be. How would we measure our ability to set this up? Where's the screen? Okay, I found it. All right, so if you notice on the left, that's pretty much a standard city block, a standard corner. It's actually a bird's eye view. If you can see that, it has the houses there as well as the corner, the street where the cars are and or where the cars would go, as well as a sidewalk. And if you notice the one on the left, it appears to be very economical, a very economical design to make the most use of space. It helps to facilitate, you know, the flow of traffic and the flow of city life in general. So we really wanted to make sure that we could incorporate some of the particular needs of deaf individuals in the design. And so we were trying to figure out if we could find a different yardstick, a different way to measure what our needs would be and how to implement them in our designs. So what we're doing is we're going to try to imagine a deaf group of people signing, sitting around in a circle signing. And really, it's not something that we necessarily would base on how hearing people communicate, but we wanted to research the way deaf people do that, to incorporate that into our designs. So really, you know, our language, our communication, the language in itself is a very visual language. When we're signing, we move a lot, and, you know, we use the space that we have. And in growing up, you know, myself trying to navigate, through the world, it was really important for me to just gain information and try to get an idea of, how things work. And I know that the deaf community in general does things in a collective way. We're a collective society. And so I basically, in my household in particular, I could figure out who was coming in and out of my house. For example, when I heard or felt the door slam, rather, I knew that someone was coming into the house. If there were heavy and hard footsteps, which I could tell by the vibration, I knew that was my father coming in. If there were light footsteps, which would tend to be quicker, I could tell that that was my mother coming in. So I learned my own ways of navigating through the world, so to speak. So, as I mentioned, you know, it's a visual language, and eye contact is very important, understandably. So in discourse, for example, my mom, she was hearing. She learned to speak sign. She's actually a great signer. And she would use my sign name, and she would say, "Hey, Robert, don't do that," or "Robert, do this," or "Hey, Robert." And she continued to use my name, and for me, that kind of jarred me. It startled me a little bit, you know. I was really looking for eye contact, and she really continued to use my name so often. And that wasn't something that I was used to. And so, in general, when we're signing, we're focusing on using space. And it's important for me to know what the other person is seeing on the other side of my hands, really. So I can see my palm, but the other person who I'm signing to would see the back of my hand. So I had to kind of see sign language from their perspective, their view of what I was saying and how we would communicate. And then also all of those things, trying to incorporate them in design as well. So this slide that we're looking at here is a picture. It's actually a bird's eye view. And really, in thinking of having a place of silence, this is a garden that was set up. The dot that you see there, if you can imagine that that would be a person, either standing or sitting, it doesn't really matter. And the two lines that you see there represent two buildings on either side of that individual. The blue line represents, first to explain, the red line represents the flow of traffic. And really, it seems like such a nice place. You know, it's a garden and, you know, pretty flowers grow there. And it would seem that it would work out very well to set up a silent environment. But it actually wasn't something that was successful for a deaf individual. And the reason is because it presented such a small scope of view, almost like a horse with blinders on. When a person walked by, you had such little notice that they were coming. Just all of a sudden, they showed up right in front of your field of vision. So it just kind of jarred me. It kind of took away the silence. It was a visual noise, so to speak. And so in order to really set this up in a way that actually presented silence, quote-unquote, for a deaf individual, it was important for a broader scope of vision to be established so that we had forewarning or foreknowledge that a person was approaching. So trying to figure out now exactly how do we set something like this up, this is what this next slide helps us to see. Really, this shows an ideal situation where you have a reflective surface, which is represented by the blue line, and with that reflective surface, you can actually see when a person was approaching. There's a wall that is dividing the two areas, and so this really gave you an opportunity to see, as I mentioned, through that reflective surface exactly who was coming. And the reflective surface, it can be glass, it can be metal. That really isn't what's important, but what that does is the forewarning and the foreknowledge helps set up a place of silence for a deaf individual. And this is talking about, you know, how you function in your space. This next slide focuses on that. Whatever activity it is that you're doing, helping a person to concentrate, you know. And then sometimes what will happen is that, you know, you're concentrating on something and then all of a sudden someone is near you, you didn't notice that they approached, and then they're tapping you on your shoulder, and it kind of wakes you up and takes you away from what you're focusing on and breaks your silence, so to speak. And that slide also showed a hallway where someone was walking, and the vibrations would give you an idea of the fact that they were approaching. This slide shows several scenarios of communication. And the number of people like that are present. So on the right, you see that there's one person and you have an easy field of vision, and you can easily communicate with them and see exactly what it is that they're signing. In the other tables scenarios, you can see that as the group grows, it would become increasingly difficult to communicate with everyone, to see everyone in their positions. The left picture on the slide shows a typical American school setup. And what you can see there are the desks. And so we can imagine that this might be like a lunchroom or something of that sort, an environment within a classroom, maybe an actual class room situation. And there on the left, we know that American schools tend to have a monotone coloring set up in the classrooms. There isn't much contrast. And there's a lot going on, you know, different students speaking. And what that does is it causes a deaf person to have to continually shift their eyes from place to place, from side to side. And that can cause exhaustion. In the second scenario, you see that there's a lot more of a contrast in the background. And rather than there being different visual points and different levels of the eye, everything is pretty much on one level, which makes it a lot easier to continually look back and forth at different things in the classroom. And, you know, I think it's important that design in itself respects our eyes and how much we use them in our communication, in our search for silence. So I remember one day, just to give you a short story, Hansel and I were walking, and we noticed that while walking on the sidewalk, we were talking to each other, and it was, and of course, we're walking on pretty standard widths, a sidewalk that had pretty standard width, and we noticed that as we're walking, we realized that we needed a larger space in order to continue the conversation with eye contact. It was important for us to have more space rather than one person having to come off of the sidewalk. So we were talking about it, trying to figure out how was it that they actually came up with the specific width of the sidewalk. And what can be done to help facilitate communication among deaf people walking down the street. So this slide shows a particular destination, and you're trying to focus on where it is that you're going, but if you see that particular red circle kind of causes a static of some sort, that would represent our destination, but it kind of makes it a little bit more difficult to gauge where you are and direction in that particular space. Peripherally, though, if there are objects on the side of you, they kind of help you gauge exactly where you are. So it gives us a little bit more of an idea of where we're going and how close we are to it, and et cetera. And I'm slowing down for the interpreter. Okay, good. Thanks. Okay. So back to a group of deaf people walking and trying to talk. And in general, you're walking and your feet are kind of trying to go forward, but your upper body is facing the person who you're communicating with so that you can maintain contact with them. So if you look at the image on the right, as you're chatting, you might be looking in the direction of the person who you're talking to, but peripherally you can see what's ahead of you. And really, if you notice that the walls and the background in the picture on the left, they kind of help stabilize the individual. For example, if you had maybe like a pole in front of you as you're walking and talking, you might be communicating with another person and not looking directly in front of you, but there's a pole coming towards you. How do you tell that pole is there, and how do you avoid hitting it? Well, we did a study involving 300 different cases And it seems like, you know, in those cases, they were still able to avoid hitting that pole, even though they weren't looking directly in front of themselves. I'm actually shortly going to play a movie, and actually just a brief clip. We can go ahead and play, and then I'll let you know what it is that went on. Okay, let's go ahead and play that again if we can, please.
No, there's no sound. It's finished. So I can control the movie? Well, you guys set it up. There's no sound, he says. Played once before. It's playing from back there. It's not on the computer. I guess it's not going to play. I guess it's
okay, so then I'm sorry, we'll just go ahead. But what it was that you saw was two people. They were walking, and if you look at the drawing, you can see that those lines represent their movement as well as the pole. And the red lines show how smoothly they were able to avoid hitting the pole. Almost in unison, they walked around it, and time and time again, they did the same thing. They were able to avoid the pole. And it seems like with the same amount of distance between them, they didn't bump into each other, they just smoothly were able to get around it. And it just kind of helps to see how architecture is like a third person in that environment helping facilitate communication. This helps us to focus more on that point, architecture being the third person. If you notice on the left, the corner, or the edge, or the corner of that room is painted blue. And the parts that are painted blue help you to see that there's something there that you need to avoid in your navigation of the room. In normal situations, if the room isn't set up appropriately, then communication would be disrupted and continued to be broken, because you'd have to look around to see what's going on around you to make sure that you didn't hit into anything. But the blue areas help to guide you through the space. The contrast in color help with that. Okay, I think the clip is working now. We'll go ahead and give that another try. There we go. That's good. If we can see it one more time, that'd be great. Okay, great. Thanks. So we see that those two individuals were already chatting as they came out of the doorway. But it seems like they were actually, even though they were looking at each other, they were still able to navigate around that pole and not have to break their conversation. If you notice the diagram on the right, that circle represents the pole. Showing how they were able to navigate around it without having to tell each other to be careful or look out for the pole, or you know, a pole is ahead. They were able to still keep that communication and navigate around the pole safely. So this shows different scenarios as well. And in this particular case, it shows how the hallways or a pathway or a sidewalk, doesn't really matter. As we mentioned, it should be wider in the event that there are several people talking, three or more, so that communication doesn't break down. And the design of that space could help facilitate that as well. So it would then also create a space, if you notice, where individuals on the right, if you notice, individuals could step into an alcove and have communication or discourse without interrupting, or without the conversation having to be interrupted. Okay, so really what I've hoped to present today was the yardstick that kind of helps us understand design, which would help facilitate communication for deaf individuals. And helping deaf people. And really, I think that setting up this space for communication is really like a deaf person's, or deaf people in general, our gift to the world. If we think about maybe imagining a situation where an airplane was set up so that, or designed in a way so that visual connectivity would continue, how would that impact everyone in the world? It's something that would be very interesting to see, our gift to the world in that way. So thank you.
All right, so I am going to speak to you a little bit about some of the creative potential of working with dedicated low-frequency sound, and in particular, this low-frequency platform driver that we have right there. I'm going to use the term low-frequency effects, which is a term often used for the dedicated low-frequency channel in surround sound systems. This actually developed for the movie Star Wars, 1970s, to create good explosions in space, which is ironic. I'm going to focus on analog-style drum synthesis techniques, which I found are very effective with this platform and for communicating these low frequencies. Now, I'm a composer and a computer musician, which means that when I go to make a piece of music, I start from scratch. I make my materials from whatever I have available, sometimes samples, sometimes synthesis. And I've had a long-standing interest in working with rhythms and polyrhythms, or independent rhythmic voices that maintain their unique identities. I've had an opportunity to work with the platform that you guys are sitting on there, and I'm working on a composition, a performance piece of music for that platform. Now, we could do a couple things to get some of these low-frequency effect percussive sounds. We could, for example, take a percussive sound, like a kick drum. That gives us a good percussive sound. And right now I'm going to play a little bit of a kick drum for you guys there. You guys feel that? It's pretty good, yeah? Let's look at a little visualization of the spectrum of this sound. We can see that most of the energy is in the range right here between 63 and about 125 hertz. That's not very low, but there's some good power and sound there. We could make that sound lower by shifting that sound down, sort of distorting the sound, analogous to playing a tape at a slower speed. If we do that, we find that the sound is indeed lower, but we lose the sharp attack of the sound, the sharp articulation. The sound also gets a little bit weaker. That's at half speed, quarter speed, and 1/8 speed. So while we get the lower frequencies in that example, we lose the percussive attack. So what are our options? Well, a great option is to synthesize the drum sound from scratch. The practice of synthesizing drum sounds from scratch extends back to early drum machines and rhythm machines, which developed out of the practice of organ auto-accompaniment machines. You weren't supposed to make music with these. You were supposed to use these at home while you played on your organ to have some sort of accompaniment. The most famous drum machine that has been around was the Roland TR-808. This drum machine was important not only for its programming interface, which allowed you to layer sounds in a lot of interesting ways, but also in its unique approach to synthesizing drum sounds. The drum sounds don't actually sound like drums at all. Well, they do, sort of, but there's a wide range of different approaches to making these sounds. This instrument was not initially successful commercially, however, it was embraced by certain musical genres, in particular, hip-hop and dance music, techno, and the like. I'll start by playing you a simulation of some of these 808 sounds through the floor panel. The clave, the famous 808 clave, comes through even though it's a high frequency there. But notice the bass, the kick, is quite strong. I'll extend that example and build a little beat over that. So first we have the kick, and then I'm going to throw in the snare. And finally, some hi-hats, which barely come through. Can you guys feel the hi-hats? I'm not sure. So this kick, the kick drum, this low-frequency source, gives us a great way of thinking about how to effectively produce these low-frequency sounds. And what I want to do is show you a little bit about how we can make one of those low-frequency kick sounds using a software simulation of something very much like what the TR-808 does. Now, what the TR-8 does is essentially use a single oscillator, a single source, to produce its kick tone. So there's one source of that kick. I love it that you guys can all feel this directly as soon as I do this. Now, what's actually happening is that that's one oscillator that's being shifted in frequency very, very quickly. A drum sound has a high-frequency component in the initial attack and then a long-frequency sustain. And what's going on is the frequency of that sound is being shifted up very quickly and then being brought back down. Now, I can spread out that process so that we can hear some of that transition. First, at the end of the sound. So we start with the initial attack that gives us the high frequencies. We can see that there. And then we have the low frequency tail. I can continue to stretch that out. We get some of the higher frequencies there. And this one will be the slowest. Now, this sound is quite different than the one we started with. However, it's the same sound. It's just that envelope is just increased and done at a very quick rate. Now, we can use these sound approaches as a point of departure. We can add other sounds. We can add some noise into there, which comes through a little bit through the floor there. Shorten that noise. Add a little distortion and modulation to that tone, and a little distortion with some frequency modulation right there. Now, As a composer, what I'm interested in is extending these techniques into new types of sounds. So I, in approaching composing for this floor, have explored a number of similar sounds to these analog drum sounds, but extended them in various ways. So we have some more low-frequency hits, some more resonant tones, extreme low frequencies, some sliding pitches. That one's kind of like a pigeon. And that one that sweeps an entire frequency range, starting with a very slow rise and fall. Now, I think these low-frequency sounds, particularly these 808 sounds, have a lot to do with perhaps some of the noise pollution that George was talking about earlier. It turns out that this low-frequency kick drum sound carries much better than acoustic drum sounds. And we've built specialized devices for expressing these sounds as loud as possible. Of course, we have subwoofers used in live sound venues. We also have, as George also mentions, special devices for car audio, which are clearly not designed just for putting the audio in the car, but also as a communicative device to spread the sound as a community, which may be annoying to some people, but is a form of expression and one that is important to this community. Now, there's a wide variety of specialized transducers similar to subwoofers, and these contact surfaces, these surface transducers, are one of them. You can go on Amazon and find these two products right here that allow you to do essentially what that floor surface is doing, create a speaker out of anything. These devices surely will not be able to handle the low frequencies of that device, but they will transduce sound directly into any surface. This one you can clearly see has a nice suction cup that allows you to put it anywhere you want. Home theater environments have also been exploring these dedicated low-frequency transducers. The butt kicker, it's pretty clear what that does. The Clark Synthesis TST-429 is actually what is driving those panels that you're on there. It's marketed for home theaters and monitoring applications for live musicians. Now to close, as a composer, I mentioned I'm interested in coming up with new sounds that take advantage of these low frequencies, but also can be used to convey complex rhythmic interactions. And my sort of hope in working with this platform was that through these tactile sensations, perhaps you can better identify and isolate complex polyrhythms. So what I'm going to play for you in closing is a little example of something that I composed for this floor. This is a sequence of four different rhythmic layers that are focused for low-frequency presentation. When I actually perform with these, I'm remixing and combining these live, but I'm just going to play them in a static way, and I'm going to add them sequentially. So hopefully you all on the platform will be able to experience this. And perhaps through this tactile sense, find a better way to keep separate the individual lines of the music. Oops, I'm sorry. For those of you not on the platform, I imagine this is an experience kind of like when your neighbor or roommate is playing loud music next door. Hopefully for you on the platform, you could actually feel those rhythms in a very tactile and physical way, and that's exactly the kind of effect that I'm going for. In closing, these sorts of novel transducers are very exciting for me because they bring us back into the space of music. And by that I mean reminding us that sound requires space, as opposed to earphones and headphones that sort of close that space off. They put us in a space and make us interact with it in a positive way, I think. I think also of these sorts of novel transducers as instruments themselves. When we work with computer and electronic music, we're using the transducer as an instrument. And there's lots of other explorations and varieties of mediums we can use to make these transducers into instruments that we play. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, I have the difficult task of keeping you all awake. Thanks for hanging in there. Hopefully the elephants will do that job for me. Elephants live in matriarchal societies with long-term memory, communication, and environmental assessment as keys to survival. They have the largest cerebral cortex, particularly the temporal lobe, get this to work. Laser pointer doesn't work. Okay. That's all right. So elephants process, they have a lot of space to process communication, vibrations, and also spatial learning and memory. Now, this makes it very difficult to come into another society and try and understand the subtleties of that society and the politics of that society, which I have attempted to do with elephants, and I think it's an interesting comparison between the hearing and non-hearing community to try and see what are the subtleties that we're missing and how do we come together and understand each other better. I hope that I'm learning over time to understand elephants better, but I'd like to...
You want to use a laser pointer?
Oh. Thanks. I'd like to also, through this experience, get to know the deaf community better. I do a lot of my work in a medical school in a department of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and they deal with the deaf community and people who are looking to bring more acoustics into their world. Now, because I deal with such a subtle society, I wanted to give you a little example of how subtle this society really, really is. Does this mic work? Okay. Here we are with an older gentleman, and this youngster here is trying to get access to the best water spot, and that's really reserved for the dominant individuals. Well, this little guy thinks he has the right to try and get in there, but the older bull is really showing kind of a gentle distraction technique of, he's not going to just go and attack him and push him away, but he's really, with his trunk, he's trying to get in there to have a drink with the Don, with the head guy, and he's like, you're not ready for this. I'm not going to do that. And he just pushes him away and uses him as a scratching post instead. And that's a really, really gentle way of displacing a youngster who's really riled up and thinks that he's you know, going to get the keys to the car and all that. So there's very different characters in the elephant world and a lot of subtleties that one has to appreciate in order to try and interpret their world. Elephants have a very low frequency ear and hence they produce, so I don't need this one, I've got three mics. They produce a signal, low frequency signal in the range of 20 hertz at a sound pressure level of 120. And this is like a mini explosion, really. And so these vocalizations hit the earth and also propagate across the surface of the earth. So these, and interestingly enough, most of our understanding of the human ear is based on the mouse auditory curve rather than the elephant. The elephant is much closer to the humans and a more low-frequency ear. And when we lose our hearing, we tend to lose the high frequencies first, which really brings you out of the range of mouse hearing anyway. So we are looking at the elephant and seeing if we can learn more about low-frequency hearing in general. Now, this is an elephant vocalization. It's produced by a bull at the fundamental frequency of 10 hertz. Now, when you put out a microphone array, you can see that... my laser pointer's not working well. Okay. You can see at 50 meters, you still have these higher harmonics, and then at 500 meters, only the second harmonic, and then at 800 meters, no evidence of others. And then out in a distance, a kilometer, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers, you really only have the fundamental frequency left, and that is that low frequency acoustic signal and vibration signal that elephants are communicating with. Now here's a group of bulls leaving a waterhole, and they have a kind of interactive sequence of vocalizations where the dominant individuals say it's time to go, he makes a call, and then the other individuals have this overlapping series of calls in response to his as they leave. Now, as I entered the world of low-frequency communication, I started out looking at insect communication, and insect vibrotactile communication, seismic communication, and serendipity had it such that I ended up studying elephants from this tiny little animal called a plant hopper. And what was interesting was when I first started looking at how elephants vocalize, they also pay a lot of attention to the ground. They freeze, they shift their bodies forward, and I'm going to show you a video of this. When a group of elephants are leaving a waterfall, sometimes they'll all freeze as a group. And this is really dramatic because they'll all be walking in a line sometimes when the camera's going to shift, and they all freeze in unison. And that became a pattern for me over time. I thought, there's really something going on here. They really are focused on the ground. And what is it? Are they detecting other elephant footfalls? Are they detecting their vocalizations? And this was my inspiration. This is the little plant hopper that I had studied, who is sending his, he's got a timbal mechanism, a drum in, between his thorax and abdomen. And with that little gramophone stylus there stuck on the stem, you can pick up the, you can raise the amplitude of the signal so that we can actually hear what he's singing to his bride who's right below him. She's shifting her weight, wondering if he's really any good. He will shift his legs, sometimes lift one off the stem, and then eventually, if he's lucky, she'll accept him. But these very simple behaviors got me thinking about elephants and the possibility that they might do the same thing. And like Sheila had talked about before, there's a whole world of animals communicating through vibrations out there. The plant hoppers are just one, but spiders, frogs, crocodiles, the golden mole, which has recently been put in the same clade as elephants, which is exciting for us, and also some evidence that the elephant seals detect vibrations, and also, of course, humans detecting vibrations. And for hearing humans, I think it's people forget that the world of vibrations exists and the importance of it maybe in more traditional societies and, of course, in the deaf community. My first foray into this world of, okay, are elephants doing this? Well, what's the first thing to do? First, look at their footfalls. Are their feet propagating in the ground? And sure enough, we put microphones and geophone arrays out and show that elephants, you have to think of the earth just like this vibrating platform as an elastic medium. And as the elephant's walking on his big spongy platform heels, he is actually making an impact on the surface. And what geophysicists study are these P waves, which are very fast-moving waves that travel through the earth called body waves. I'm going to forget about using this pointer, sorry. But here, down here, you see these surface waves. The Rayleigh wave is what animals are using to communicate with, and it's the thing that breaks up parking lots and bridges in an earthquake. It's what an elephant, that mini explosion, when he rumbles, he creates a surface ripple, and other elephants can detect that ripple. And so my interest was in how well do they detect this ripple? Are they detecting vocalizations? How far away from the source are they detecting them? And to what level of sophistication? Now here is that same P wave is what seismologists want to use for assessing earthquakes and how far away they are. But that very high amplitude signal, that's the Rayleigh wave. And that's what geophysicists try and get rid of in order to see the P wave. So it's very difficult for us to try and then go back and put that Rayleigh wave back in. Now, here is just an example of different species walking. In our first recordings, we realized that there's a different signature attached to these different species as they walk, and we might be able to use the ground as a censusing mechanism to count how many elephants are coming into the waterhole. That was one elephant that you just felt, and now this is a whole herd of elephants walking in to the waterhole. And these are all the noises of their footfalls in the ground. This is recorded through a geophone in the ground. Now, here's a hemsbuck, another type of antelope, much more spiky. You can see the impact of the elephant is much more wavy, like the human, which is interesting, whereas if you imagine the weight distribution of a giraffe, he's more on his stiletto heels on the trampoline versus the elephant on the platform heels on the trampoline. It's quite a different signal, and it has a structural integrity that you can use algorithms to extract elephant, giraffe, lion, etc. Now, this is our field camp in Etosha National Park, Namibia. This is where we're doing all these studies. So then I'm going to walk you through a series of experiments. One, do elephant vocalizations propagate in the ground? Two, can they detect those vocalizations as a meaningful signal? And three, how sophisticated are those signals? And four, how far away could they be and still detect the signal? So here we are burying all of our geophone instruments, which is a geophone is just like a microphone a magnet and coil microphone in the ground, measuring vibrations in the ground versus those that are in the air. Now this is, so I'm tempted to use my pointer. All geophysicists take a sledgehammer and hit the ground, and then they have to see what the sound, how the sound is going to move through the ground. Through the air, it's very constant, 340 meters per second, 344. But in the ground, it depends. The soil velocity changes everywhere you go. So you need to know what that is in order to know how a signal's traveling through the ground. So all of those squiggly lines there are 60 geophones spaced every 3 meters over 180 meters. And at the head of that line, we hit the ground with the geophone. And you can see there's the sound wave at 340. There's the Rayleigh wave at 430 and the P wave at 1500. Then you replace that sledgehammer with an elephant, ask him kindly to rumble, and you do the same thing, and indeed there's the Rayleigh wave, the sound wave. And why you would go through all the effort to measure these things is to prove that that sound in the ground has its own structural integrity in order to show that that sound will not bounce back in and out of the earth, but it has a communication value over long distance. So, in fact, we show that this is indeed the case. Now, I want to go and play sounds, vocalizations through the ground and see how elephants respond. I'm going to take a signal that I know they respond to, and this is elephants responding to lions that are hunting. And the first piece of it doesn't really affect them, but it's these three vocalizations at the bottom in the sonogram. Here's the matriarch coming to inspect to see what's going on, and she hears these three sounds. Now, this sound I had created and was using with farmers to try and help keep elephants out of their cornfields. Multitasking there, working with the Namibian government. But I knew I had a signal that I could play in the ground and would be evocative. And because, like I said before, elephants are very subtle, you can't trust how to interpret them, so you have to keep repeating experiments with a very minimal differences between the social situation in each experiment and know the signal that you're giving them. So, to give you the punchline up front, they do indeed respond to these vocalizations propagated in the ground. And this was done over a series of experiments. And mostly at night, the female elephants like to come in at night, so all of this is done through night vision. This is also just to show you that the signal that we're delivering through the geophone that's in the ground, that geophone is measuring the level of the signal in the ground, and we have microphones to show that there's no signal in the air. The elephants are only responding to what we deliver through the ground. And this is how the data is collected. The elephants, they either freeze, orient toward the source, scan, clump up into tighter groups. And this is just collecting the data, and then I'll show you a response. So here the elephants are coming in. And this is time lapse. They're drinking. We let them drink for a while, and then we deliver the signal, and they freeze. And then in a few moments, they will clump up into their family groups, which is a sign of vigilance and security to protect them against this potential threat. Okay. So then our fourth question now. So the elephant vocalizations are in the ground. They can detect them, and they can detect subtle differences. That last experiment, we played back the same kind of alarm call, but from a different region, and they only responded to the one from their own region. And this is what got me excited in the medical community to think, if there's such subtle frequency discrimination ability in the elephant's foot, can we use that in our own experience of vibrations and train ourselves to understand frequency resolution better in the vibrotactile world? What we did next, I'm running out of time, so I'm going to quickly go through this. We trained an elephant to touch targets in response to feeling a vibration. And this is Donna, the elephant at the Oakland Zoo. When she feels a vibration, she'll touch the square target, and I've cranked the level of vibrations up so you can detect it yourself. If she doesn't feel it, she'll touch the triangular target, and if she's correct, she gets a treat. And so in this way, we can ask Donna, how small of a vibration can you pick up in your feet, so that we can then go back in the wild and say, how far away from the source can an elephant detect a vibration? Yeah. And one of the reasons we had to do this is because, like we were saying before, there's so much noise in all environments, including the ground. There's so much noise in the ground that it's very difficult to get these calculations in a quiet environment. The anthropogenic noise of generators, even radio noise, even 60 hertz cycle electrical noise. I'm just going to skim through these. There's two different pathways to detect vibrations. One is through our skin, the other is through our bones, and you're probably experiencing both of that by sitting on that force plate, and many different animals use either signal. And we have shown that elephants have both pathways, and then we're trying to show, okay, which pathway do they use, are they more likely to use? And this is this one last experiment where I sped it up because elephants are kind of slow in nature, and it's very useful to get a sense for what they're doing, and also within a talk you can show this whole sequence. They're focusing on the ground, really putting the trunk on the ground, freezing, rather than scanning with their ears, which they normally do for an acoustic signal. So they seem to be preferentially right now navigating by a ground-borne signal. And just at the end of the clearing here, we'll play it back to him again. And this is an estrus call, and it's bull and must. He's interested. And here again, he turns, orients, and then comes back in. Okay, and that is, we have to stop. And I just want to say that I'm also interested in what I've learned with elephants, bringing into the hearing and non-hearing community and trying to learn a bit more about vibrations through a lot of different techniques and hopefully through communication between the two communities on how to develop ways of appreciating vibrations more. And thank you very much.
We're finishing, and everyone here will be glad to know that we have an extremely valuable attention award waiting for each of you on that table. You can keep this as a permanent memento of this evening. But we in